from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, is the Chinese Communist Party trying to use the daily White House coronavirus briefing to change the narrative about their culpability in the worldwide pandemic? Gordon Chang is here with us in just a moment. And as state governments stay, as their stay-at-home orders and bans on assemblies, including churches with meetings of more than 10 people, move into a second month, questions are now being raised if these restrictions are a violation of religious freedom. Dr. Paul Marshall, professor of religious freedom at Baylor University, is here with an answer. Also, as we've been encouraging churches to do, they are, in fact, thinking and acting outside the box, the four walls of the church building. Marcus Point Baptist Church in Pensacola, Florida, will be holding a sunrise service at the Blue Wahoos Stadium. But there's a catch. Pastor Gordon Godfrey is here to explain. And Travis Weber will be here with an update on the battle raging in the states over whether or not abortion is an essential service. And finally, David Clawson, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, will join me for a discussion on the decisions churches now have to make over whether or not they will take federal money offered in the SBA Paycheck Protection Program. Be an interesting conversation. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at TPerkins. And by the way, I mentioned this yesterday. For those of you who live in my neck of the woods, small portion of you, but we do broadcast on 88.1 right outside of Baton Rouge. We'll be having a sunrise drive-in service in my home community of Central, which is just outside of Baton Rouge. I'll be hosting the event along with area pastors. It will be at 7 a.m. at the Central Football Stadium parking lot. As we talked about yesterday, come as you are, but stay in your car. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in both the health and economies of America. I mean, this is a two-front war. We're fighting a health crisis and an economic crisis. And while some Americans are using due diligence to follow government recommendations of social distancing, American businesses are suffering. So who's to pay for this? Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee have suggested China, the country this whole mess came from, that they should pay part of the bill. But the question is China now using the daily White House briefing to try and change the narrative about their culpability in this worldwide pandemic? I want you to listen to this clip from yesterday's briefing with the president. He had an exchange with a reporter with a Hong Kong-based TV, Phoenix TV. Listen to this.
I mean, I hope they're going to honor the deal. We'll find
out. China? Are you cooperating with China?
I don't know. Who are you working for, China? You work for China or are you with a newspaper? Who are you with?
Hong Kong Phoenix TV.
Who owns that, China?
It's
is it owned by China?
Hong Kong.
No, is it owned by the state?
No, it's not. It's a private-owned company.
Okay, good. Okay.
Well, joining me to talk more about this is Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China. Be sure and follow him on Twitter, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much, Tony.
All right, two issues here. You actually wrote about China should pay a financial cost for its coronavirus lies. That was published today. You suggest that they should, that they bear responsibility in how this unfolded.
Well, they certainly bear responsibility. It was only on January 20 that China admitted that coronavirus could be transmitted human to human. But the Chinese leaders actually knew about this about the second week, maybe the third week of December. And they not only just tried to keep this secret, which would have been bad enough, they actually tried to convince the world that there was no such possibility of human-to-human transmission. And because of that, Tony, countries around the world did not take precautions that they would have adopted if they thought it was human-to-human. And so clearly what China tried to do was to spread this disease, because although I don't know what Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, was actually intending, if he wanted to cripple other societies, he would have done exactly what he in fact did.
And you say they had an accomplice in this. China did not know whether or not they acted alone or in concert with the World Health Organization. Certainly the World Health Organization gave them cover.
Well, they certainly did. There is that infamous January 14 tweet from the WHO, which said, relying on China's assurances, that there was no human-to-human transmission. Also, WHO took Beijing's line and said that there should be no travel restrictions imposed on people coming from China. People coming from China, Tony, they're the ones who spread the disease outside of China's borders. And so WHO, on balance, actually spread this disease around the world. Yes, it did some good things, but on balance, it was a malign influence.
Well, Gordon, I don't know if the president read your piece or not this morning, but he certainly was on the same page with you. Earlier this morning, he tweeted out the WHO really blew it for some reason, funded largely by the United States, yet very China-centric. We will be giving that a good look. He suggested as well that WHO covering the tracks. In particular, he took issue with them being against the travel bans, which he went ahead and he pointed out that he did anyway.
Yes. On January 31st, President Trump did something which was absolutely essential. He imposed travel restrictions and quarantines on China. He got enormous heat from Beijing from that. And also, he got enormous heat internally from the United States. But it was absolutely the right thing to do.
Let's talk about this for a moment, because in both chambers, there is movement to try to hold China accountable for this. You talk about this in your piece, which, by the way, folks, you can find a link to it at tonyperkins.com. Should China pay a financial cost for its coronavirus lies? Now, the issue here is, what would be the means by which they could be held accountable?
Well, one thing, we hold, or China holds, more than $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries. And just with the stroke of the pen, President Trump can seize those. I think that he should do that. I think he should do that, though, in coordination with the issuers of the other major currencies, Canadian dollar, British pound, the euro, Swiss franc, and Japanese yen. If he does that, then the United States doesn't take a propaganda hit from China, which actually would be quite devastating. So I think that we should be working with our friends. We can do this, and we can show the Chinese people that the world condemns their regime.
Now, you point out in your article that China has no good retaliatory options if the United States and allied companies were to take this step.
Yes. Well, what they could do is, of course, move against U.S.-owned assets in China, which are on the order of about $260, maybe $270 billion. But if they were to do that, Tony, they would be really cutting off a critical lifeline for them, because they need foreign business to jumpstart their economy, which is now at a standstill. So, yes, they could do that, but at the end of the day, they'd be hurting themselves far more than they'd be hurting the United States.
And so, Go ahead, Gordon.
No, I think that it's important we understand what they can do to us, but ultimately, we do need to get our companies out of China, because they are potential hostages.
So, and you track this. I mean, we've had you on the program for a long time talking about China, and so you're very, very knowledgeable about what's happening there and what's unfolding. Are they, in your opinion, at one of the most vulnerable points they've been in, where the United States now can exert its independence and strength as it pertains to China? I mean, we've been so intertwined with them economically and from a standpoint of dependency on all of their the goods we import from them.
Well, they're much more dependent on us than we are of them. Our dependency right now really relates to pharmaceuticals and medical protective gear, because they manufacture an outsized proportion of what we use. But we can change that relatively quickly. China needs the United States, though, because its economy, because of the coronavirus epidemic, is at a standstill. The first quarter GDP, gross domestic product, for China probably is going to be at least 10% negative year to year, maybe even more. They need foreign business. They need our markets. And so clearly Beijing is not in a position to dictate terms to the United States. We, however, are in a position to tell them what to do.
So we're, for the first time in a while, in a position of strength, and we have a leader who understands how to use it.
Yes. President Trump, unlike his predecessors, has been willing to use American power to achieve goals for the American people. Prior to him, we've had presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, who were really much more concerned about the welfare of communists in China than they were about, for instance, American workers. President Trump has completely reversed that. And so I think we're on the path to a much better China policy. There's a lot more that we've got to do, Tony, but I think the president is moving in that direction fast.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. Gordon Chang, my guest. His Twitter, Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, let me ask you this. I'm going to go back to what I mentioned at the top of the program here. Yesterday, a reporter with Phoenix TV, Hong Kong-based, but links to the Chinese Communist Party in the White House. And then the president even called her out for saying, well, that sounds more like a statement than a question. I mean, has it gone so far the Chinese are trying to place reporters in there to change the narrative and move the focus away from their culpability and what's happening with this pandemic?
Oh, definitely. If you listen to the reporter's initial words, as President Trump pointed out, it was a statement. It wasn't a question. She was repeating Beijing's narrative about the generosity of China in terms of donating medical protective equipment. And she would have actually just given the Chinese line if the president had not stopped her. Now, Phoenix TV has links to China. It is part owned by the regime. Part of it is not. But its content is actually determined by the Communist Party. And so this is clearly a Chinese state television outlet. And, you know, we should not be allowing them into the White House briefing room because we couldn't have, for instance, New York Times or Wall Street Journal or Fox News question Xi Jinping in a live setting. So there's a reciprocity issue here.
Yeah, I see that all around the world when I travel different places. That's true on so many different fronts, how America, we allow access, we allow freedom that no other country would give to an American moving about in their countries. And I also, the media criticizing the president, saying his line of questioning of her was not appropriate. I mean, of course, now they're silent after it has been established that there is the connection to the Chinese party.
Yes. Well, Phoenix TV has always parroted Communist Party lines, and its propaganda line is actually determined in Beijing. It was started by a former colonel in the army, and essentially it is, it says what Beijing wants it to say. You know, it's very clear that this is China talking to us.
Well, I'm glad the president saw it for what it was and called it out. Gordon Chang, thanks so much for joining us. Always great to talk with you.
Oh, thank you so much, Tony.
All right, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang. If you want to follow him on Twitter. All right, when we come back, a lot of talk now as we're going into the second month of these ban on assemblies, including church meetings of more than 10 people. Is this a violation of religious freedom? We're going to talk about that next with the Wilson Professor of Religious Freedom at Baylor University, Dr. Paul Marshall. He joins us for that conversation next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away. We're back after this. Is historic masculinity lost forever? Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in a culture of gender confusion? We need men to be men, tough with compassionate strength, bent toward justice without compromise, locking arms and standing. We need to be the men God created us to be and fight for all that is right, true, and just. This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference. To find out more, go to standcourageous.com. This conference is led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will invest in you, helping you understand your role as a defender, a provider, an instructor, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, so that you can have the generational influence that God has designed you to have. Learn more at standcourageous.com. That's standcourageous.com.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast, so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So glad that you have decided to join us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. But here's a better way to stay in touch with Washington Watch and all that's happening in our nation's capital and in your state as well. We have the new improved Stand Firm app. It allows you to contact your members of Congress directly from your phone so that you can encourage them to make the right decisions. Go to the App Store, Stand Firm, or go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over. It's the new and improved Stand Firm app. In fact, if you've got friends who are unable to listen to Washington Watch from one of the 350 stations which air the program, they can actually listen to it on the Stand Firm app. New and improved. Go to the App Store, Stand Firm. All right. As I mentioned at the top of the program, we're moving into the really the second month in some places where governors, state and local jurisdictions have put in place bans on assemblies, including church meetings, of more than 10 people. Now, we're coming up on Easter. Now, I've been encouraging pastors and churches to think outside the box and continue to minister and to meet in ways that are in compliance with the government. But many are saying this is a violation of religious freedom. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Paul Marshall. He is the Wilson Professor of Religious Freedom at Baylor University and has written a thoughtful article on this. Dr. Marshall, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much for having me, Tony.
Well, I first off want to, again, you know, in the past we've talked more about international religious freedom. I want to thank you for your work on international religious freedom. I've borrowed from your work quite extensively in my work as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, so I'm grateful for that. But I say that in context also of our conversation here. I think both of us have that perspective of what religious persecution is when we see it happening globally. And we then look at what's happening here during this period of time in which we have a health crisis. So I'm just going to throw this question out there to you, Dr. Marshall. Are these restrictions on meetings taking place right now in some jurisdictions, most jurisdictions across the country, a violation of religious freedom?
In general, no. I mean, obviously, neither you nor I know what's going on in every jurisdiction, and people
Correct.
May have crossed the line
Correct.
Somewhere. But in general, the restrictions on, you know, not having more than 10 people or 5 people gathering and apply to everybody, including church services. I don't think that's a undue restriction on religious freedom. It's you can limit things for public health reasons, and in this case, that's what most governors and mayors have been doing. So I think they're legitimate restrictions.
So the one aspect is that it's legitimate. There is a need. It is applied uniformly across the board. So religious organizations are not targeted with this, and it is the least restrictive means possible to accomplish the health goal.
Yeah, I would say, again, in most cases, the three criteria you mentioned, it fits. It's trying to be the least intrusive. It's not singling out churches or other religious bodies. And there are good grounds for it. We're in the middle of an epidemic.
Now, I this is very simplistic, but how I have talked about this and what I have seen in other parts of the world is that when it's the message and not the meeting that is the target, or both, the target of the opposition. We're not seeing that, at least in, as you said, in everything that I'm aware of. And I'm not saying it's not happening somewhere. It could be. Could have a zealous local official. But when you're talking about a limited meeting as opposed to many places around the world that are restricting the message, that's where you clearly get into the grounds of violation of religious freedom.
Yeah, it's religious freedom is centered around the particular mission of a church or other body. Can it do what it's called to do?
Right.
One example I gave in the article is, you know, a fire marshal can close down a church building if they think it's unsafe. But they're not targeting, as you've so well put it, they're not trying to target your message. They say, you know, get this building in shape and you can carry on as you want, or talk outside. So it's when the fundamental mission of the church is being restricted that we see restrictions on religious freedom.
Historically, when you look at the church, and I've been communicating, I mean, my message is, let's not think about what we can't do. Let's think about what we can do. Let's use this as a moment of creativity. And when you look at the history of the church, some of its greatest movements came because of restrictions that were placed on it, that it went out. Like, I go back to the early church in Jerusalem. They left Jerusalem and took the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the known world because of the opposition and the restrictions that were there present.
Yeah, and we have so many opportunities like that. You know, we've got radio, we've got television, we've got internet. Now you have these new conferencing mechanisms. I was at a sort of meeting, virtual meeting last night with about 25 pastors from my town discussing how are they responding to the closures and making suggestions for each other. So there's tremendous opportunities. Here we can reach millions of people, and lots more people are on the internet, and lots more people are listening to the radio, and lots more people are watching TV.
Well, I know that we will have further discussion if this is not short in limitation or short in time frame of these restrictions, because then it crosses over into the issue of religious freedom. But for now, they are they're limited in their scope, and as you said, there is a justifiable reason for these limits on meetings. So, Dr. Marshall, I want to thank you for joining us. And again, thank you for the outstanding work that you've done on behalf of religious freedom.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Tony.
All right. Dr. Paul Marshall, Wilson Professor of Religious Freedom at Baylor University. I mean, he's a professor of religious freedom. He says as well that these restrictions, limited in their scope, uniformly applied and justified because of the health crisis, are not an infringement on religious freedom. Now, if they kept going on and on and on, then we would have that conversation. All right, I want to have a conversation on the other side of the break with a pastor who, as we've been encouraging, is thinking outside the four walls of the church. In fact, they're holding a sunrise service at the local baseball stadium. But there's a catch. Pun intended. We'll talk about it next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
What are you reading this spring? At FRCblog.com, we have timely and original commentary on the issues facing our culture today. Our blog is written by our policy experts, the Family Research Council team, and outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Some of our most recent blog posts include, "To abandon the nuclear family ideal is to abandon being human." "Why does the abortion industry hate women?" "China uses coronavirus to oppress religious minorities," and many more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and to stand for truth. With our blog, we hope to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at FRCblog.com. Again, that's FRCblog.com.
The Fairness for All Act was recently introduced to the House of Representatives after the passage of the Equality Act. In response, FRC has come out with a new publication, The Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. Despite having the best intentions, it is an ill-advised and poorly drafted bill that does not achieve its goal. If this act is passed into law, it would allow the federal government to impose a belief system and ideology about sexual behavior and identity on all Americans. The Fairness for All Act would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. To access this resource and to learn more, go to frc.org/fairnessforall. That's frc.org/fairnessforall.
Welcome back to Washington Watch, the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, we've been taking stories from churches across the country of how they are thinking and acting outside the box, the four walls of the church, to continue to do the ministry of the church, to pursue our mission, to get the message of the gospel out there. And in fact, this coming Sunday, the biggest day of the year for churches. I mean, some pastors have described it as the Super Bowl of the church. It is Resurrection Sunday. It's one of the two times that people that generally don't attend church on a regular basis come to church, Christmas and Easter, Easter being the biggest. One church that we are well familiar with, Marcus Point Baptist Church in Pensacola, they are actually taking their service outside the four walls of the church to the local baseball stadium. But as I said, there's a catch. Joining us now to talk about it, Pastor Gordon Godfrey, senior pastor at Marcus Point Baptist Church in Pensacola. Pastor Gordon, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thank you, Tony. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. In fact, I told Jeremy, and full disclosure here for our listening audience, Jeremy was the worship leader at the church that I was serving as pastor at until Pastor Gordon took him. But that's another story. We won't go with that. I've been watching your services online, doing an outstanding job of continuing to minister, and I know you're doing things in the community to help people during this time. And as a result, you've been invited to host a service this weekend for the community, it'll be broadcasted on television at the local baseball stadium. But tell us the catch.
Well, the catch is there won't be anybody in the stadium except for our team, and we've had to even reduce the number of people that are going to be on our team. Normally, we have 5,000 people that come to this sunrise service every year, but we're going along with the social distancing and making sure we're doing what we think is the right thing to do to be safe, and so we're going to host the event, but it'll just be our team there doing the service, and nobody will be in the stadium.
But the entire city will have the opportunity to see that sunrise service.
They will. Thankfully, we've gotten several of our local TV stations that are going to pick up the service. One of our country music channels, Cat Country, is going to broadcast it over their radio station. And, of course, it'll be online on YouTube and Roku TV, and it'll be on our website. So we're probably going to get way more coverage than ever before. I think it'll be a huge crowd.
And this is what I like about this, because, you know, so many would say, oh, we just can't do it because we're not going to have a crowd. Nobody's going to be able to meet, so let's just cancel it. And he said, no, we're not going to cancel. We're going to continue to minister, take the message. This is the – if there was ever a time people needed a message of hope, this is it. And look at the doors that are opening for that message to go out more broadly than it's ever gone before.
Well, you're right. I mean, before we were dependent upon – the number of people that could come to the stadium. The stadium seats about 5,000, and we filled it up. But now, with this opportunity that God has blessed us with, we're going to be able to expand our boundaries and enlarge our tent, and we feel like, oh, I don't know how many people. They'll be in the thousands of people all over the country that'll be able to see it this time.
Pastor Gordon, talk a little bit about what your church has been doing in terms of ministry during this time of you know, I would just describe it as crisis. I mean, people are uncertain. There are people that are at home, people unemployed now. How has your church been ministering to the Pensacola community?
Well, one of the things that, you know, people right now are dealing with is they just can't go to the grocery store. And so we've been doing a lot of food drops for people. We take them food, leave it outside the door, and text them, tell them that we dropped the food on the doorstep for them. We've also encouraged our church to do what we're calling Takeout Tuesdays. And our church family goes out, they go to local restaurants, and they buy their food, take it home and eat it, and buy some extra food, take it off and drop it for another family. And so that's one of the ways that we're able to minister. We've also been going into the hospitals and taking food to the healthcare folks. I mean, they're just working 24 hours a day now. It's nonstop.
Yeah.
They can't even get food. So we're taking food in, and, of course, you have to go through all the protocols and do that, but that's one of the ways that we've been ministering to families.
And the community is responding as a result. It's going to be a great Sunday sunrise service there in Pensacola, Florida. So, Pastor Gordon Godfrey, thanks so much for stopping by here at Washington Watch and just sharing with us what Marcus Point Baptist Church is doing there in Pensacola.
Hey, Tony, I appreciate it. And they can go to PensacolaChurch.org. PensacolaChurch.org. Watch it live Sunday morning.
All right, very good. Pastor Gordon Godfrey of Marcus Point Baptist Church. Again, if we just won't focus on what we can't do, but rather focus on what we can't do, look at the doors that open. I mean, here's a service, 5,000. That's great to have 5,000 at a stadium on a regular year. But because they can't have the 5,000 there, it's gotten the attention of the local television stations because they're going ahead and doing it anyway. And so they say, well, let's broadcast it. So now instead of reaching 5,000, who knows, tens of thousands that they will reach with this message. You might not be able to fill a sunrise service at a stadium, baseball stadium, but you can do something somewhere. Whatever God has given you the ability to do, do it. Don't think about what you can't do. Think about what you can do. All right, more Washington Watch to come. When we come back, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council, joins me with some breaking news out of the Fifth Circuit Court as it pertains, Fifth District rather, as it pertains to Texas and abortion clinics. That's next here on Washington Watch. Also, David Clawson will be joining me for a conversation about whether churches, how they should approach this federal money that's coming through the Paycheck Protection Program. That's next. Don't go away. Where can young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of real manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of gender confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will help you understand your role as a defender, provider, instructor, battle buddy, and chaplain so that you can have the generational influence God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com.
Recently, a bill called the Fairness for All Act was introduced to the House of Representatives. In response, FRC has a new resource, the Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. But, unfortunately, it is a poorly drafted bill that would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. Learn more at frc.org/fairnessforall.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast called Lecture Me was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. And as I mentioned, if you happen to live in my area this coming Sunday, we'll be hosting a sunrise service. I've been working with some local pastors, 7 a.m. at the Central Stadium. And it'll be a drive-in. Come as you are. Sit in your car. And actually, we'll be taking up a collection for the local food bank. So I know that not everyone listening can drive to that drive-in service, but for those in my area, you can come. Find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. All right, as I mentioned before the break, this just came out, a Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. I said Fifth District. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Texas as it pertained to emergency medical services. Joining me now to talk more about this, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council. Travis, welcome back.
Thank you, Tony.
Now, these have been popping up around the country as non-essential medical services have been all kind of postponed, so all of the energy, effort, material, equipment, medical personnel could focus on the coronavirus cases, making sure that we didn't take up ICU beds that were needed for the coronavirus patients. There's been a battle that has been raging over abortion in certain states. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, Tony. So this is one of the dynamics that we have seen develop throughout the country on issues that FRC tracks and we see intersecting with the coronavirus, specifically as the nation's medical communities divert attention and resources to caring for those affected by coronavirus. We've seen abortion advocates lash out and try to claim that they deserve exemptions from this and trying to get special treatment to ensure they can continue to perform abortion despite the need to divert medical resources toward the coronavirus patients and healthcare burden on the healthcare system. So a number of states have decided that no, they're not getting special treatment. medically unnecessary anything not medically necessary, surgeries and everything else that goes on in the medical system is not necessary, should be postponed. Ohio, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Iowa, and Alabama are states that have declared that they're going to take this approach. But you see abortion advocates in other states, California, Massachusetts, Washington, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, taking the approach that they're going to declare abortion to be essential and medically necessary and allow it to continue despite the need to deal with the coronavirus emergency at this time. So you have a split among the states, and these the states who've the first group of states, some of those have been challenged by abortion advocates in the courts, as those advocates insist on this special treatment, trying to get the courts to issue rulings upholding their demands and allowing them to continue to perform abortion. So this ruling out of the Fifth Circuit now pertained to a Texas order that said abortion's part of the group of medically unnecessary procedures that are going to be put on hold. That was challenged. It wound its way through the district court to the Fifth Circuit. Now you have the Fifth Circuit upholding Texas' approach right now.
So, folks, a couple of things here. One, the reason for this, the rationale, is that there are a limited number of ICU beds, and they wanted to make sure that those were available for the COVID-19 patients so that they would have the equipment. With the bed comes the ventilators and all of the other things that are needed in critical care cases. So they want to try to stop anything that would unintentionally or unnecessarily potentially take up one of those beds. So all non-essential medical procedures were stopped. Now, we've talked about this before. Abortion in many states, not all, but in many states is regulated just as the ambulatory surgical centers, outpatient surgery. So they treated the same when it comes to the regulations. So if those facilities are told not to operate, then abortion facilities should not be operating either. Now, Travis, secondly, the issue here is that a court deciding that abortion is a non-essential medical procedure probably carries some very significant is a very significant ruling, because this could have implications beyond this.
It could, Tony, and we've yet to really dig into the opinion here that the Fifth Circuit issued today. But I think one of the legal questions is what limits can be put on constitutional rights, or in this case, so-called constitutional rights like abortion, in states of emergency like we're in. So we'll have to look at that. I think, certainly Texas' approach is a prudent one. I'm looking at the executive order now, Executive Order 09 that Governor Abbott issued, and that order says that facilities shall postpone all surgeries and procedures that are not immediately medically necessary to correct a serious medical condition of or preserve the life of a patient who, without immediate performance of the surgery, would be at risk, et cetera, and so on. So it's a very prudent approach, and Texas has quite rationally said and put abortion providers on notice, hey, you don't fall within this. So they're kind of looking at the medical system as a whole and proceeding. I think this is a common sense approach, and I'm glad the Fifth Circuit upheld it.
But there's a reason here. I think the abortionist would not or would be incensed by this, because they don't want abortion to be in any form or fashion labeled as a non-essential medical procedure. They've been playing this all along that abortion is health care, when in fact it's not. It's not essential. And I think with the courts weighing in on this, this could have significant ramifications in the way abortion is viewed, not just in times of crisis, but in general.
It could. And they certainly, it's almost like these suits that have been filed against states, the states like Ohio, Texas, Alabama, and that first group of states that I mentioned, you have these abortionists almost in a situation where they're lashing out because they see this as a real threat, when in reality, what we're doing is saying, hey, let's deal with the crisis on hand. Sorry, you don't get special treatment to continue your shameful activities because those activities are actually diverting from healthcare needs of the larger system.
Right. Well, very interesting. We'll watch this as it unfolds, because it may end up having a split in among the circuit courts, which means this would ultimately end up as a question that the Supreme Court would most likely have to deal with. Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate all the work that you do on guard there at the Family Research Council at the Policy and Government Affairs Shop.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, stay up with what Travis is doing. Go to TonyPerkins.com. You can follow the links over. Constantly working. I mean, there's so many things unfolding during this time that our policy shop and government affairs team are working on constantly to ensure that faith, family, and freedom is protected. I want to transition in our final few moments together to a question that's actually percolated up as we've been talking about. In fact, it was Travis's team that worked day and night on the CARES Act, the phase three that they called of the measure coming out that provided for the relief to small businesses through the SBA, the Small Business Administration, through the loans in the program in particular called the Paycheck Protection Program. Now, we worked to ensure that that was inclusive of religious organizations, including churches and nonprofits, because they were told, churches were told not to meet. You know, we just had this conversation in the last couple of segments. They were told not to meet. Therefore, they didn't meet. They weren't able to take up their offerings and collections and so forth and do the ministry and the work that they intended to do. So they abided by the government. The government impacted them. And so we said, well, they need to be a part of this. Now, questions have come up. Should the church take money from the government? And I want to talk about that. Joining me now to discuss that is David Clawson. He's the director of our Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview section here at the Family Research Council. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
All right, let's just jump right into this. We don't have a lot of time, but churches, is there a problem with churches taking this money from a theological standpoint? Let's start there. Is there a theological position, a biblical position, saying churches should not take this money?
Yeah, it's a great question, one that I'm talking with a lot of pastors about. Just to be clear, congressional leaders, the Small Business Administration, even President Trump have made it very clear that churches are eligible to apply for relief. So it's not a matter of whether they're eligible and can apply for these relief funds. It's because they are. But it's a question of wisdom. Is it wise for churches to take money from the government? And really, I've thought about this, Tony. I think that every pastor, elder board, deacon body, who's ever responsible for making decisions for a local church, they need to pray about it. They need to consider their unique situation, their unique circumstances. But I do think they should at least know what is available to them in the Paycheck Protection Program, which is responsible for allocating $349 billion. One theological question that I think is a part of this conversation is, does accepting a loan, even if it's a forgivable loan during a time of emergency, does this mean you're not trusting God? I talked to a pastor about this yesterday, and you know, my answer to that is I think obviously everyone needs to check their own heart. Yeah. You only know what your own motivations are, but I don't think there's anything inherently wrong about accepting money from the government in an emergency situation. You mentioned it, Tony. At the end of the day, it was the government in the name of public health and safety that ordered these churches not to meet. So personally, I don't think it's wrong to apply, but I do think that the overall question of applying for these loans, it's really a Romans 14 issue. This is a matter of individual conscience.
Yeah, I would agree. I could make an argument to say you can, and I would make an argument to suggest that you shouldn't. But at the end of the day, I think it's a matter that pastors and churches and other religious nonprofits should just pray about. In some cases, you may be completely, feel completely free to do so. In other cases, you may not sense a freedom from the Lord to do that. And I mean, I could use biblical examples. I mean, the Old Testament, mm-hmm. One of the first ones that comes to mind is Nehemiah. when he went back to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and even before him, Ezra with the temple, and how that was funded by the government. So, you know, there's certainly biblical precedents where money came from the government to advance the work of God's people. But again, I think what you said is wise. And I would encourage every pastor, every church to know, first off, it's available. In fact, you can find more information, all the information you need to find out about this. You can go to frc.org/church, and we've got the resources up there, the frequently asked questions about this program. There are no strings attached. You know, you don't have to surrender your biblical views on issues. It is, as you said, a forgivable loan. You can pay it back if you want. Or it will be forgiven to you if you use it to cover your employees over this 2.5 month period.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I do encourage everyone to go to frc.org/church where we lay this out. And is it, you know, like you said, these churches can apply for these loans, and as long as they're used to cover payroll, pay their rent or utilities or meet mortgage payments, it will be forgiven. But even if a pastor does accept this and then says, you know what, maybe this wasn't the right thing for us to make with in our unique situation, they can pay back this loan over 2 years at 1% interest. And so that's part of this bill.
I mean, I just, you know, the thing you brought this up, people say, you know, am I trusting God or trusting government? I think we do need to be careful that our trust is not in government. And now God can use government to provide, I think, on occasion, like in this situation. I mean, clearly you could justify it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is, as you said, what is the Lord directing you to do? Is this a faith-building exercise for your congregation? In fact, some congregations don't need this because they've not missed much. Their people have been continuing to give. In fact, folks, I encourage you to continue to give to your church. Mail in the check, drop it by, continue tithing. You know, God can use this as a faith-building exercise in the lives of many. But it, again, to be repetitive, at the end of the day, pastors and churches, the leadership has to decide what to do.
That's us. And the theologians use the word, Tony, adiaphora. It's neither morally right or wrong. It's a matter of the conscience. And so I think if churches think they need this help after prayer and consultation, they should probably apply. And if their conscience says no, then I think they probably should pass on the opportunity to get one of these forgivable loans.
Yeah. But to be clear, I want everybody to know we were working to ensure that there was no impartiality in this, that
right.
You know, just because you were non-religious, you had opportunities that the religious did not, the religious organizations. But that does not mean, just because we fought for it, that you are required to take it. Again, that's up. That's between you and the Lord. David Clawson, thanks so much for joining us. As always, great to talk with you.
Thank you, Tony.
So, folks, we're going to advocate for the church, for people of faith, making sure that they're treated just like everybody else. And again, in this case, because they were impacted by government orders and directions, we felt that it was appropriate for them to be a part of this program. But that doesn't mean we suggest that everyone should participate in it. That, again, is up to you. All right, folks, out of time for today. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Until then, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.